From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Republicans poised for major gains in U.S. elections. Are Israeli-U.S. relations in crisis?
Now we have two specific issues that are problematic in the relationship.
UNHCR launches global campaign to end statelessness. And 25 years later, looking at Germany's reunification as a model for the Koreas. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. voters head to the polls today in midterm congressional elections that will shape the final 2 years of President Obama's presidency. Republicans are favored to gain seats in the Senate and House of Representatives in an election framed by a sour national mood and security concerns at home and abroad. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview of today's election.
All 435 seats in the House of Representatives are at stake in Tuesday's voting, as well as 36 of the 100 U.S. Senate seats and 36 of the 50 state governorships. Most analysts predict Republicans will expand their House majority and have an excellent chance to win back a majority in the Senate. Republicans need a net gain of 6 seats now held by Democrats to win the majority. Polls show voters are unhappy with President Barack Obama and the direction of the country. Frank Newport is with the Gallup polling organization.
So I would say, kind of undergirding everything else that Americans may be concerned about, the economy and the availability of jobs clearly is at the top of Americans' minds this year.
The midterm stakes are important for President Obama, who's been urging Democrats to ignore the bleak predictions from experts and get out and vote.
Cynicism didn't put anybody on the moon. Cynicism has never ended a war. It has never cured a disease. It did not build a business. It did not feed a young mind. Cynicism is a choice, and hope is a better choice.
But the president may be fighting history. Two-term presidents usually suffer party losses in Congress in the second midterm election. And Mr. Obama's low public approval ratings may be hurting Democratic candidates around the country. Republicans like former National Committee Chairman Mike Duncan are cautiously optimistic about the chances of retaking a majority in the Senate.
But these races, particularly the Senate races, are very local races. And we have good candidates this time. I think we do have the wind at our back. But it's not over yet. We can't take this for granted.
Duncan says Republicans are doing all they can to nationalize this year's elections as a referendum on the president and his policies.
Well, I think the headline is that the country turns away from President Obama. We're moving the country back to being the center-right country that the American people want.
Midterm elections usually center on domestic issues, but this year the rise of the Islamic State in the Middle East and fears about the spread of Ebola have shaken the public in the final weeks of the campaign. Norman Ornstein is a political analyst with the American Enterprise Institute.
You have individual candidates and Republican candidates who have some serious weaknesses, and the best way to go around that is to nationalize an election at a time when people are unhappy and believing that things are out of control and that government's not working and that the president is not competent.
Several of the key Senate races this year are in Republican-leaning states, and late polls show many of those are trending Republican in the final hours of the campaign. The Center for Responsive Politics estimate that spending on this year's elections will reach about $4 billion, the most expensive congressional elections in history. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The Israeli finance minister recently warned that Israeli-U.S. relations are in crisis and in need of repair. Some experts believe he may be overstating the situation. VOA's Cecily Hillary asked Alan Elsner with the J Street nonprofit advocacy group his opinion.
I think that there has been a slow but steady deterioration in the relationship. And I don't think that I would say that we're in a crisis, but I think that we are headed toward a crisis if the trends continue the way they are.
We've certainly had our differences, the two countries. I think back to Henry Kissinger blowing up at Yitzhak Rabin and President Clinton snubbed Netanyahu at least once or twice when Netanyahu was visiting Washington. But the two countries have always managed to get past their differences.
I mean, I look at it, there's also the famous confrontation in George W. Bush and Jim Baker in 1990.
Yes.
1991, which was also over settlements. I look at it in two ways. The underlying relationship, which is expressed in kind of a myriad ways in daily cooperation, in military cooperation, cultural exchanges, tourism, academic exchanges, business ties, is extremely deep, extremely wide, and extremely strong. The relationship between Israeli governments come and go, U.S. administrations come and go, and there have been ups and downs in those relationships that are usually spurred by specific issues. Now we have two specific issues that are problematic in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is Iran, and the second one is settlements and the kind of two-state solution. So on Iran, there's a clear difference between the Israeli government and the Obama administration. I think that everyone is now waiting to see if there's going to be an agreement with Iran. And if there is, then I think we can expect some very, very angry words and some very strained, you know, battered feelings on both sides. And I think that, but there isn't actually much that the Israelis can do about it. But the one thing that they could try to do with it, which would really, I think, damage relations in a very serious way, is that they could try and undermine the president by invoking the Congress against him. Let me just say, you know, hypothetically, let's say, mm-hmm. let's assume that there'll be an agreement on Iran,
mm-hmm.
and that the Iranians retain the ability to
enrich uranium.
Uranium, right.
Yes.
If Israel actively, or even trying to keep its fingerprints off it, but, you know, tries to line up, mobilize opposition to try and sabotage the agreement through the Congress using mostly Republicans, but mm-hmm. also some Democrats,
mm-hmm.
then I think that you're going to have a real problem. The second issue is the settlement issue.
Mm-hmm.
And here I think that, again, I think we're heading towards a number of crises and breaking points, because the administration will be in its final 2 years. We're not expecting to see any major peace initiative. What we're probably going to see instead is Palestinian initiatives to join international organizations,
yes.
and to go to the UN and get a UN resolution, and that's going to put the administration on the spot. And at the same time, Israel's own supporters, I think, including J Street, that I speak for,
mm-hmm.
view the settlements as an obstacle to peace. We actually view them as illegal under international law, and we're calling on the administration to call them illegal under international law,
mm-hmm.
which the United States used to do until 1981. It was the Reagan administration that dropped that formulation. So we think that the Israelis are going to find that a lot of their supporters in the United States, including probably a majority of the American Jewish community, are not with them on this. And there's this kind of sense that the extremist settler lobby in Israel is actually driving the bus.
Mm.
And that Netanyahu either is a member of that lobby, although he still professes support for the two-state solution, or he's just allowed the bus to be hijacked.
Alan Elsner, Vice President for Communications at the J Street Advocacy Group, which calls itself pro-Israel and pro-peace.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The UN Refugee Agency is launching a global campaign to end statelessness within 10 years. The so-called I Belong campaign aims to lift millions of people out of the legal limbo in which they live, because they have no nationality and are deprived of all rights of citizenship. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the campaign in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports at least 10 million people are stateless, and every 10 minutes a baby is born stateless. Most stateless people have no legal rights in the countries where they live. The UNHCR says legally stateless people do not exist. They have no identity, no birth certificate, and no documents. Therefore, they have no access to public health, education, or legal employment. In some countries, stateless people who die are not even granted a death certificate. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres says a number of factors contribute to statelessness. He says most situations arise from discrimination based on ethnicity, religion, or gender.
The most well-known and well-discussed case in the world is the Rohingyas in Myanmar, more than 1 million people, which, of course, are not granted citizenship, or many of them, the majority of them, were not granted citizenship. In Myanmar, they are considered to be illegal migrants from Bangladesh, but if you go to Bangladesh, they will be considered to be illegal migrants from Myanmar, which means that the overwhelming majority of the Rohingyas have no rights, no citizenship at all.
Other countries with large stateless populations are Ivory Coast, Thailand, Latvia, and the Dominican Republic. Statelessness also occurs when a country breaks up, as happened with the former Soviet Union and former Yugoslavia. Restrictive laws denying women the right to pass their nationality on to their children on an equal basis with men is another major cause of statelessness. At present, 27 countries have such regulations. The UNHCR says new risks of statelessness are emerging with the growing number of conflicts. For example, it notes wars in Central African Republic and Syria have forced millions of people to flee and become refugees. Tens of thousands of refugee children who have been born in exile are not registered at birth. High Commissioner Guterres says this is a huge problem for Syrian refugee children born in Lebanon and Jordan. He says Syria does not allow women to confer their nationality upon their children. He says this could result in many babies unable to get registered at birth because their fathers may have been killed or gone missing.
We have been working with the governments in order to facilitate the procedures to allow for Syrian children to be registered, and there is indeed a lot of progress on that, and we are hopeful that that progress will allow us to make sure that in the future all Syrian refugees, children born in exile, will be able to be registered as Syrian citizens. At the present moment, 70% of the newborn Syrian refugees in the neighboring countries have not yet been registered.
Guterres says statelessness is an anomaly in the 21st century and must be eradicated. He says there has been an important shift in international attitudes regarding this tragic phenomenon, which makes him hopeful that this global campaign will succeed. He says the UNHCR believes statelessness can be resolved with enough political will. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This month marks the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, a Cold War icon that symbolized the divide between East and West. It paved the way for German reunification and the end of communist regimes across Europe. But a Cold War-era border still remains in Asia, on the Korean Peninsula, where there are practically no signs of reunification. From Seoul, reporter Jason Strother looks at Germany's quarter-century-old integration to see if it can serve as a model for North and South Korea.
When residents of East and West Berlin breached the wall that divided their city for three decades, it was an image seen around the globe. Not so in communist East Germany's close ally, North Korea. At that time, Park Geun-ha was in his mid-20s and completing his military service in the North. He says very little information about Germany's reunification made it through. We were not told why the two Germanys reunited, he says. He recalls that North Korean media portrayed the fall of the wall as the result of corrupt opportunists in East Germany. Park says it was not until he defected to South Korea in 2005 that he learned the full story. The division of the Korean Peninsula is a lasting legacy of the Cold War. Thousands of families remain separated by the demilitarized zone. Cross-border dialogue is scarce, and military tensions often run high. But some observers say Germany's experience could help guide both Koreas to eventual reunification. Bernard Zelliger heads the German Hans Seidel Foundation in Seoul.
Germany certainly is a very interesting case to look at. There are not many successful unifications, and very few which happened peacefully. And in that sense, it's understandable that the Koreans look at Germany.
But Zelliger says there are as many differences in the German and Korean situations as there are similarities. For instance, there is greater economic disparity between the two Koreas than in divided Germany. There are a lack of social institutions, like German churches, and unlike Western Europe at the time, there are many unresolved territorial and historical disputes among countries in Northeast Asia. And Zelliger notes that Germany's unification created many new problems for the country. It took many years to overcome wealth and cultural gaps between the East and West. He says those difficult times made South Koreans leery of German-style integration at first.
I saw times 10, 15 years ago when the Koreans said, South Koreans said, certainly we don't want to go the German way. It leads to massive economic challenges. It leads to internal rifts.
He says it took about two decades for most of the inequalities between Eastern and Western Germany to disappear. But Zelliger and other Korea watchers note that the potential cost of unification here make many younger South Koreans uninterested in uniting with the North. Lars-Andre Richter, head of the Seoul-based Frederick Naumann Foundation for Freedom, says after nearly 70 years of division, that disinterest might not be surprising.
They are too young to remember that. I mean, even their parents are too young to remember the undivided Korea. You lose the emotional link.
Richter says that is unlike in Germany, where national division lasted about 40 years. North Korean defector Park Geun-ha, who now works for an association of former North Korean government officials in Seoul, is not so sure if German unification is the right model for Korea. He points out that East German leaders agreed to reforms before the nation was absorbed by the West. Such a move is considered impossible in today's North Korea. Park says it would be an ideal situation if the North Korean government becomes more democratic and peacefully moves toward reunification, but that is not likely to happen. Pyongyang will not give up its power, he says. Park adds that, like Germany, unification on the Korean Peninsula will suddenly happen, but only after North Korea collapses. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
South African state prosecutors have appealed the conviction and sentence given to track star Oscar Pistorius. Pistorius was found guilty of culpable homicide for shooting dead his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, last year, and last month began serving a five-year prison sentence. But South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority had said it was disappointed with both decisions. The NPA said Tuesday that it has filed an appeal in the North Gauteng High Court. It said it could not discuss the matter publicly until judgment is delivered by the court. Pistorius originally faced more serious charges of murder, but the judge ruled that prosecutors did not prove that he shot Steenkamp intentionally. Japanese stocks climbed to a seven-year high today, continuing momentum from last week when Tokyo unexpectedly expanded economic stimulus measures. The benchmark Nikkei index rose 2.7%, or nearly 450 points, to end at 16,862. It was the first day the markets have been open since Friday, when Nikkei surged 4.8%, its biggest daily gain in 18 months. The rally was sparked by Tokyo's unexpected move to increase the money supply to help fight deflation. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.
This is Today in History. On November 4th, 1677, the future Mary II of England married William, Prince of Orange. The couple would later jointly reign as William and Mary. In 1825, New York Governor DeWitt Clinton poured a keg of Lake Erie water into New York Harbor, commemorating the completion of the 584-kilometer-long Erie Canal. On this day in 1847, German composer and conductor Felix Mendelssohn died at the age of 38. In 1921, on this day, Japanese Prime Minister Hara Takashi was assassinated. A right-wing extremist stabbed him, unhappy at reports that Takashi was planning to withdraw Japanese forces from Siberia. On this day in 1922, British archaeologist Howard Carter discovered the entrance to the tomb of King Tutankhamun in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt. Excavation later revealed the solid gold coffin of the boy king preserved for more than 3,000 years. In 1956, the Soviet army, backed by artillery, tanks, and warplanes, crushed a brief Hungarian revolt against the Soviet-backed communist government. Thousands were killed and injured. On this date in 1979, supporters of the new Islamic regime in Iran took dozens of people captive at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran after the deposed ruler, the Shah, was allowed to enter the United States for medical treatment. Although some captives were freed, 52 Americans would be held for a total of 444 days. In 2008, Barack Obama became the first black person to be elected president of the United States. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew recently met with Egypt's finance minister, Hani Dimayan, in Cairo, Egypt, and discussed the steps Egypt has taken in advancing its economic reforms. Secretary Lew indicated that these economic reforms reorient the Egyptian national budget toward improving the lives of the Egyptians, including boosting spending for social programs, reducing inefficiencies on subsidies, and will be critical to strengthening the macroeconomic environment. These steps will help Egypt invest in its people so that all Egyptians can share in the country's growth while putting Egypt's budget and debt trajectory on a more sustainable path, he said, noting both he and Minister Dimayan agreed that creating jobs and opportunity for all Egyptians must be at the center of the reform agenda. We discussed Egypt's need for external assistance in order to support the long-term, broad-based, sustainable growth and greater economic security, Secretary Lew said. We also discussed the rule of law and how creating an open political environment in which individual rights are fully respected would further boost Egypt's ability to attract international investment. We also discussed plans for the International Monetary Fund to conduct an assessment of the Egyptian economy later this year, he continued. The multilateral development banks, with the support of the United States, have already provided assistance to Egypt. This includes the World Bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and the African Development Bank. The development banks will be critical in helping Egypt to invest in infrastructures, expand access to financial services, and help support small businesses. I look forward to the upcoming publication of Egypt's detailed medium-term macroeconomic plan and to Egypt continuing this positive momentum over the next few years, Secretary Lew said in conclusion. I look forward to continuing our dialogue and enhancing the economic partnership between our two countries to help build an Egypt that can grow and support jobs for all Egyptians in the long run.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.